Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we go a little bit under the radar. So many earnings calls this last week. You probably heard about Target and a number of other retailers out there. We're going to start with a fairly major retailer in Best Buy, but then we're going to go a little bit underneath the surface to talk about two retailers that didn't generate a lot of press last week, but that we feel like are worthy of discussing here on the podcast. A reminder, like us, rate us, however you do access us, whether that's on iTunes, we're on Spotify as well for those Spotify listeners out there, for those that maybe listen on a different platform that have Spotify, we are there, as well as just about any other podcast listening service. You can also check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. I just put up a picture from a JCPenney I went to showing their relatively sad appliance section, just two appliances left in that particular section. So make sure to check those things out. So as we mentioned, we're starting off with a big earnings call from Best Buy. Best Buy beat Zacks analyst consensus estimates by nearly 16%, coming in with adjusted earnings per share of $1.02 versus estimates of 88 cents. And their headline, and this is the main reason I wanted to cover it, because usually we'll look up, even if we don't cover a retailer, we'll look up their earnings call, maybe listen to the earnings call. But the headline on Best Buy's investor relations page was literally, and I quote, "Best Buy reports better than expected first quarter earnings," as they were triumphant about this quarter in every way. And for context, it's highly unusual for a retailer to be this bullish about their own earnings call, but Best Buy was exactly that here. And Leighton, this is a retailer that you can describe as having an up and down last 3 years, but not necessarily in terms of the company's results themselves.
Best Buy has been pretty consistent as an organization despite a number of initiatives and exits from concepts like the pivot away from Best Buy Mobile, where you saw them exit a number of locations within indoor malls. Analyst sentiment has not been consistent, though, as they've been alternately critical and supportive of Best Buy's movement as an organization. So we look to this quarter, dive deep in earnings. The earnings call was on Tuesday of this week. It was for their first quarter for fiscal 2020, with the quarter ending May 5th. We start with the revenue trend, as enterprise revenue was up around $9.42 billion, or up to $9.142 billion. This was slightly up from the first quarter of 2019, where they ticked in $9.1 billion. The revenue increase was a function of two things mainly. This would be really good if you're a shareholder. You want to see this company grow, because prior to the last 3 or 4 years, this was a retailer that was really stagnant. You really had to wonder, does this big box concept for the electronic industry really work? After all, you have seen them take away staple products like compact discs and other things in replace of toys and more TVs and more washers and dryers. So it has been a change overall, especially if you look at their services division. But that would be domestic same-store sales and domestic online sales, a huge win for them. We'll start with same-store sales, as they were up 1.3% in the United States. This was up against tough comps from last year too, by the way, as comps are now up 8.4% domestically on a two-year stack. So yes, they did outperform over 2 years ago when you were seeing that comps were really skyrocketing. So they are being a little bit taken back from that, but still really good to see positive numbers there for domestic same-store sales. We should mention that this is more or less in line with non-food and fuel inflation for the quarter's time period in the United States, and maybe even slightly outpacing inflation when you exclude things like non-germane categories. The inflation when it comes to fuel was likely a main component behind Best Buy's increased supply chain costs this quarter, by the way. As an aside, and this really has nothing to do with Best Buy, but we actually haven't talked about it on the podcast yet this month. Food prices deflated for the first time since 2017 on a U.S.-wide basis in April. We'll see how that manifests itself on earnings calls going forward, particularly in the food industries. But back to the actual subject at hand, we see domestic online comps were up 14.5%. which we find to be a healthy number for their category. This, of course, way off pace from a retailer like Walmart, but with Best Buy not being a general merchandise retailer and having a fairly mature online presence, this sales increase is certainly one we see as acceptable. They've been hitting double digits for quite some time, and of course, there will always be analysts clamoring for an e-commerce sales increase that is maybe a little bit greater, but the reality is we feel as though they've struck a correct balance between their stores and their online presence. For context, their domestic online comps were up only 12% last year, and last year's first quarter was very strong on the comps front overall. So we see an increase over that 12% this year, again, to that 14.5% figure. International sales did not look so great, with comps down around 1.2%, Trent. So this brings us back to their overarching strategy. This was the final earnings call for Huber Joly as CEO, and with their current CFO, Corey Barry, slated to take over as CEO in June. Joly will actually stay on as executive chairman on the board. However, we'll see how long that lasts, but really good to see a little bit of change at the top, despite, in our opinion, a really solid last couple of years. They've been attempting to execute on their internal strategy called Best Buy 2020, building the new blue. And Trent, this strategy has really manifested itself last year in the acquisition of GreatCall, but also the closure of the 105 Best Buy mobile stores, which we had alluded to just a little bit earlier, and also the closing of 12 larger format stores around the U.S.
Yeah, and regarding those store closures, when they were announced, we saw a lot of headlines saying things like Best Buy to close hundreds of locations, but realistically, the mobile locations were largely kiosks and malls and the like. I'm sure a lot of those retail lovers out there saw these type of locations. The 12 large format store closures, honestly, largely in line with most retailers' attempts at revisiting the functionality of their store base. When you consider how large the Best Buy store base is, the 12 large format store closures really just a drop in the bucket. But when we turn our attention to the Best Buy 2020 strategy, it includes, stop us if you've heard this before, a pivot into the services industry, much like Office Depot and Office Max is endeavoring. Only there's some very interesting forays into service by Best Buy, including the acquisition this quarter of a senior health services company called Critical Signal Technologies. Basically, they look at this as a fold-in acquisition to work with other portions of their services businesses, like the Geek Squad. But it's unusual. I don't think 10 years ago, if we were discussing Best Buy, we would have said, yeah, they're going to acquire a senior health services company that's basically available through contact centers and the like, because just didn't fit with Best Buy's concept as of that time. But they're looking to pivot more and more towards the service, in-home services, that type of thing, whether that be through Geek Squad or some of their other in-store setups. And they feel like a health services company apparently meets with that overall goal. Now, one interesting thing we noted on the call is part of their 2020 strategy away from moving into services is Jolie's mention of a lease-to-own program across 70% of their store base in the quarter. Now, this is something that we've talked about them testing out in the past, but this was a major rollout this quarter. And in case you're wondering, yes, Best Buy does offer an in-house credit card as a method of financing, and they've done that for a very long time. But the company said they wanted to enable customers that maybe couldn't qualify for the card, particularly those with a limited credit history. So here their focus isn't so much those with bad credit, but those more with a limited credit history to try and create, and something I talk about a lot on this show, habitual consumption at Best Buy. So their feeling is if they can attract those buyers now, they might have a Best Buy buyer for life. Now, the odd thing from our perspective is that actually, when you look at rent-to-own businesses, they aren't currently seeing a lot of momentum, a lack thereof, in fact, lately. And this is something that we've talked about with both Aaron's and Rent-A-Center. We've seen businesses like Aaron's pivot away from their core business of rent-to-own and begin to offer third-party services as a way to boost revenue. That pivot for Aaron's includes a virtual lease-to-own company called Progressive Leasing, which is actually the exact third-party service that Best Buy is using to put on this program. So Best Buy, Aaron's partnering up here. In Best Buy's case, this is essentially an add-on program, so not a lot of risk here. This isn't something where, when we talk about Aaron's and Rent-A-Center, if they don't see a lot of momentum with the rent-to-own program, it's not going to sink their company like it would those two organizations. But if you look at Best Buy, if they get even 2% more sales, let's say, on larger ticket items, whether those be laptops or gaming systems or appliances, and then you figure in slight income from the Progressive Leasing Agreement, which charges an additional $79 per customer to, in effect, put that rent-to-own on a product, it'll probably be worth it for Best Buy. So again, not a lot of risk here. And despite the fact that we're somewhat bearish in the current market on rent-to-own services, I do think this is a good platform to Best Buy. And again, the key for them will be to attract younger customers without much of a credit history. Jolie's exact words were that, and I quote, "It will allow us to catch customers early on in their credit history. The hope would be to build a long-term relationship," but really, as they referenced it on the call, it sounded as though they're fishing for tuna and casting nets in the ocean or something like that. But realistically, you know, in terms of how the economy is going now, yes, they're looking at customers early in their credit history, but having this program in place, if there were to be an economic downturn and suddenly you get people needing financing on things like appliances or like computers or tablets, this program would already be in place. So the nice thing is they won't have to scramble were there to be an economic downturn. Not saying there is going to be one anytime soon, but just looking at U.S. history, it is somewhat cyclical. You'll get those downturns every now and again. So if you were to see another one where people don't have quite the liquid income that they have right now, at least that program is in place and ready to go. And they'll be ready to, ironically enough, compete against companies like Rent-A-Center or Aaron's, who we talk about are negative beta companies where basically they see more success when the market as a whole doesn't see that success. Additionally, what we found interesting, Leighton, when we were looking at the categorical breakdown in their earnings call, is that some categories that retailers have found to be struggling, Best Buy saw a lot of success in. And honestly, I wasn't surprised to see growth in appliances because we've seen other retailers have growth in appliances. But they mentioned wearables and tablets, two things that other retailers have been talking about. They've had a hard time moving off the floor.
Yeah, they certainly have. Best Buy saw growth in appliances, but you know, this is an area in which you've seen a lot of other retailers fall out of. Sears, JCPenney, appliances, of course, we referenced earlier this year with JCPenney, as Trent just talked to you about. But you really have to think about the larger image overall for Best Buy. If you've been to a JCPenney store, by the way, in the last month, the appliance sections have been looking rather sad as they clearance off the remaining sections. But you look here and you see that Best Buy is at least holding their own against the likes of Lowe's and Home Depot. And that's what I mean about sort of taking a larger picture view of their business going forward, because those are two powerhouse hitters in terms of appliances. Yes, sometimes they lack in terms of the service department. We've talked about our firsthand experiences with both Lowe's and Home Depot, but both of those have seen purchases of large ticket items increase not only over the past few quarters, but the past few years. And we've also heard some retailers express concern over market saturation when it comes to wearables and tablets. So another concerning thing if you're Best Buy, but with Best Buy, they've been able to leverage their in-store mobile presence to take advantage of new models on the Apple Watch front and others as well. And they do a really good job in terms of really staffing their stores with what they call sales experts. So these are people that are dedicated to just one particular section, one specific section of the store. And no, I don't mean just tablets or just phones. These are people that are brand experts. So if you're an Apple fan, a massive fan of Apple and love everything that they put out, these people are there to help support your purchase and give you all of the new ins and outs of a particular device. And I think that's extremely important if you go into the store, because that, after all, is why people still shop in stores, is to get that experience and that firsthand knowledge. Additionally, when it comes to tablets, we've seen an increased number of inexpensive models hitting the market, no doubt helping draw those in who haven't already purchased a tablet in the past. And we're curious to see how that's reflective when this holiday season hits, because tablets, because they are at such a low price point, pretty much a stocking stuffer at this point for some families that don't already have that particular product. But they did see declines, Best Buy did, in the entertainment category, which has been nothing new for retailers in this space. As customers and content creators shift to a more direct-to-consumer model, the same change has hindered retailers like GameStop in the recent past, who still struggles to maintain their traffic levels. As far as their online sales are concerned, Best Buy increases are fueled by both higher order values, or what we call ticket sizes ordinarily, and increased traffic conversion, not mentioned as a big driver here. So conversion meaning more people may be coming into those stores, but we don't necessarily have all of the proper information as to are those customers purchasing large ticket items, or are they purchasing even anything at all? So that conversion would be a little bit helpful there. Online revenue now makes up about 15.4% of their overall domestic revenue, a higher percentage than most domestic brick and mortar retailers. Again, this speaks to the fact that they've been building out their e-commerce platform for some time now. So it would behoove you as an analyst or a shareholder or just a fan of Best Buy to not just look at those online comp numbers. Being up 12 to 15% quarter over quarter, it is a really good number. But for people to complain about maybe wanting to see a 30 or 40% increase for their e-commerce division, it is doing just fine if you look at the big picture, the big piece of the pie where you see overall domestic online sales coming in. Buy online, pickup in store accounts for around 40% of their online revenue. Again, another good sign for the company. The increased capability of buy online, pickup in store was credited to their most recent supply chain build-out that actually began 2 years ago, back in 2017. But the higher e-commerce revenues also speak to some of the Best Buy 2020 initiatives, which include same-day and next-day deliveries to major metropolitan areas. Currently, they offer same-day delivery in 40 metropolitan areas and free next-day delivery on orders above $35 to around 77% of their customer base, or in 60 total markets. That is a lot, Trent. That is some really good penetration for their omni-channel initiatives. As with other similar programs, not all SKUs are eligible for next-day shipping, but we would like to see maybe more product selection available for these types of programs going forward, and that is certainly one thing they are not shying away from. One thing that we have not heard of this year, Trent, on the earnings call or on any earnings call from a retail company is a company thanking the president's administration when it comes to tariffs.
Yeah, this has been something that's unusual because a lot of retailers are fretting a little bit about the tariffs. And Jolie, there was some context here. Jolie said that the administration he felt has done a great job of reaching out to retailers for feedback with the design of limiting the final impact on consumers that these tariffs will have. And like I said, something that we haven't heard yet and haven't heard insofar as most retailers are pretty clear about needing to at some point pass along tariff impacts to consumers, and Jolie seemed to indicate that that's going to be somewhat mitigated, at least for the tariffs that we have so far. And he went through breaking down the lists of tariffs. He said that largely they've been able to mitigate tariff impacts mostly through either purchasing and stockpiling items prior to the tariffs being implemented or being able to work with suppliers to drive their prices down to kind of account for those tariffs. However, there were a few warnings on the earnings call as it pertains to tariffs. First, there was a mention that accessories were largely impacted by the List 3 of tariffs that went into effect last September. Now, this will have some impact on the company and perhaps prices for the consumer. Second, Jolie warned that List 4, so the List 4 of tariffs, which has not yet gone into effect and may not indeed go into effect. It just kind of depends on what happens really over the next couple of months or years, but that comprises a great number of electronics and core items for Best Buy. So the fact that List 4, there's a little bit of danger there, he feels like. If that list were to be implemented at 25%, the result would be price increases, and he said that retailers, and I quote, would be shelled by U.S. consumers. You have to think that at some level, this was a not-so-veiled message to the administration in terms of foreshadowing potential negative impacts. Now, despite the fact that Best Buy's earnings were positive, that they beat analyst estimates, investors turned kind of bearish about Best Buy after the earnings call. The stock went from $69.20 at the close of business on Wednesday, or the close of market on Wednesday, all the way down to around $66 at the beginning of trading on Thursday. Some of this was because they had talked about a little bit of a lull in tech innovation, but again, there's a lot of positives here in that they feel like there are higher profit margins to be had for some of their newest acquisitions, particularly in the services sector. So you kind of wonder about that as the stock closed just shy of $66 at week's end. What were investors really expecting to hear on this earnings call? Of course, tariffs are going to have a potential future impact, and of course, that might be the case, but it seems like Best Buy endeavoring to diversify enough so as to mitigate potential impacts on earnings in the future. Now, for our second story, we move on to a retailer we've discussed in passing recently, but one that's been killing it in terms of same-store sales. That retailer is Foot Locker, who released their quarterly earnings on Friday. Lately, they've been tallying same-store sales increases at or around double digits, and that's pacing a retail sector that includes the likes of the newly private Finish Line, portions of Dick's and Hibbett as well, the latter of which, and Hibbett, actually released their earnings on Friday. And it's at this point that, as we always do when we discuss Foot Locker, we have the obligatory reminder that Foot Locker isn't just Foot Locker, but they also run Champs Sports, Kids Foot Locker, and Foot Action, among other brands. Now, those four are their major ones, but as we've discussed in the past, their Lady Foot Locker brand has slowly been folded into their other brands as they attempt to take advantage of an increased push towards female athleisure wear in their flagship brand. So basically, Lady Foot Locker becoming redundant for them. They also own East Bay, which basically started out as a catalog-centric retailer, now known as mostly an e-commerce retailer. Anyone who was even remotely active in the 90s and 2000s probably remembers getting those East Bay catalogs in the mail. Granted, the prices were a little bit higher in those East Bay catalogs, but I remember getting those at the very least quarterly at my house as I was playing athletics in the 90s. Now, one of the reasons we're talking about this earnings call, and Leighton will get into the numbers here in a bit, but we're really talking about the earnings call so as to look into the categories that we're doing well at Foot Locker. Foot Locker does one of the best jobs in the retail industry as a whole in breaking down where their momentum was at in terms of sales, not only by brand, but also by product category and by sub-brand that they sell. So they were talking about things like Nike and Adidas on the earnings call, one notable exception we'll get to here in a moment. But as we talk about the numbers, Foot Locker's expectations were lofty as analysts projected an increase over last year's adjusted earnings for the quarter. They came in at $1.45 per share last year, and Zacks' consensus estimates actually had them coming in at $1.61 for this year. Zacks' analysts' consensus estimates seeing quite a bit of an increase, and as far as reaching those lofty expectations, it couldn't quite do that.
No, they couldn't. They couldn't quite reach those expectations, coming in with adjusted earnings per share of $1.53. Still better with last year, but below analyst high marks for this quarter. Unsurprisingly, this was not covered in the headline or subheadline of their earnings press release. They're wanting to shy away from negative news. Overall, the health of the chain is still strong based on the numbers. And so while we might have seen a little bit of a pullback here versus expectations, they really have been, on an earnings per share basis, doing quite well over the last couple of years, and they did notch here recently comparable store sales increases of 4.6%. We are reminded of Richard Johnson's quote from a few years ago in which he declared that mall retail is not dead. He was emphatic on that point. We're inclined to agree in that differentiated mall retail is still alive and well for the likes of Foot Locker and Bath & Body Works, who have seen similar same-store sales increases, by the way. So their total sales there, excluding exchange rate fluctuations from their international businesses, increased a similar 4.7%. And as a result of their numbers, they reiterated earlier guidance for most major categories, including some same-store sales and gross margin arenas. You see here, selling, general, and administrative expenses were up as a percentage of sales from around 19% to 20%, reflecting increased expenditures on infrastructure and digital initiatives. They do expect some reinvestment into their brick-and-mortar sales as well. And you see those brick and mortar stores are looking to be refreshed throughout the United States to accommodate their changed product mix, which Trent will get into a little bit later. It's not only a matter of refreshing locations for Foot Locker, but they are undergoing a constant evaluation of their store base, which is something that we've really driven home over the past few years when we've covered a company such as Foot Locker. In this quarter alone, Trent, they opened 14 new stores, remodeled or relocated 13 stores, and closed 34 stores. Funny quick story, I was in Houston about 2 years ago, which seems like a long time now. Time really flies. But overall, you see this dead indoor mall with maybe only 13 outlets. Foot Locker, one of the last ones hanging on. So I'm sure they still have a lot of lease obligations out there for these older conventional indoor malls that haven't refreshed to be in a differentiated state. But it is interesting to see that Foot Locker is usually one of the main brands or name banners that we see left over in these aging malls. So I'm sure that these stores are going to be closed in due time, but it is just an interesting story to note that everybody else, Aeropostale, American Eagle, all of those other retailers usually have left by the time that Foot Locker is still around. And while media has focused more on the closures overall, we should keep in mind that it isn't a one-way street for many retailers. With Foot Locker in particular, we're in support of the idea that they probably do need to close some of these locations, the aforementioned C-class locations that I'm referring to. Foot Locker is one of the few retailers still going in some of these locations. Trent visited a C-class mall recently, I guess, where a Foot Locker was surrounded by, on all sides, by vacant stores. And this is similar to my story. In some ways, it is a testament to the chain's success that these type of stores are still open. And we don't know the number. So in all reality, they could be in these C-class malls and actually being the better performing store out of all of the remaining stores still doing business. We should also keep in mind the fact that of the 20 net store closures for Foot Locker, 10 were either in Europe or their Pacific operations and not in the US. Three more were actually Lady Foot Locker stores, which again, the company is attempting to exit as a concept entirely since it is becoming a redundancy with their product mix in their full line stores. But Trent, you look at the breakdown of sales. Once again, Foot Locker as a company showed comp store sales increases in all portions of the quarter, particularly in April, as April benefited from the Easter shift and March was actually negatively impacted. They do include e-commerce, by the way, in their comp store sales figures. Excluding e-commerce, brick and mortar comps were still up 2.9%. So that figure can be a little bit misleading at first, but then you look and you see, oh no, brick and mortar stores are actually doing quite well still for the chain, largely a result of increased conversion on the store level. Conversion, another buzzword coming from the Best Buy story. This is good though, because this means that despite maybe lower than expected traffic levels at some of their locations, the people that are coming in are buying. They're buying, and they're buying shoes that are not at an inexpensive price point. Direct-to-consumer was up 14.8%, which is in line with the increase at Best Buy we discussed earlier. And even though they are in a different retail segment, both retailers have a fairly mature e-commerce segment. To wit, just like with Best Buy, direct-to-consumer accounts for around 15% of Foot Locker's total sales as a company, not a number to scoff at.
No, and again, you're looking at not only Foot Locker, but brands like East Bay, who have done the majority of their business online now that they're moving away from a catalog-centric model there. As far as breaking it down by brand within the company, Champs Sports was the main driver for sales increases, and they saw the largest net store growth as well during the quarter of any brand in the chain. Comps for Champs Sports were up double digits, and that puts them in the same sentence as Bath and Body Works, is one of the most successful mall retailers. And so when you look at their CEO, Foot Locker CEO as a whole, Richard Johnson, saying mall retail is not dead, he has good reason for that. Champs Sports, which is again one of their largest brands within their portfolio, they have more than 1,000 stores in the U.S., those comps up double digits. So it's not a matter of a fluke. Again, there was no Easter shift in or out of the quarter, just within months within the quarter. And so these comps for Champs Sports, very promising going forward. And they've been one of the main drivers of Foot Locker's overall comps in the U.S. Now, when you look at their flagship brand, Foot Locker, in the U.S., they saw mid-single-digit growth. East Bay, once again, was up low single digits. So you're seeing a slight increase there. You're not seeing the push towards e-commerce at East Bay quite what you are at the brick and mortar stores. Is again, East Bay, that primary e-commerce retailer. So you don't see it pop quite that much as what you're seeing at Champs Sports and Foot Locker US. On the negative side of things, Kids Foot Locker, despite being a brand that the company wants to build out, and they in fact opened 3 new Kids Foot Locker stores in the quarter, they were down low single digits, and the company here blamed a lack of high-demand apparel releases for the softness when it came to the kids division. Additionally, Foot Action, another brand the company is bullish on and another one that saw store openings in this last quarter, despite the fact that they're kind of an oft-forgotten about mall retailer, they were down high single digits. This was blamed mostly on softness in demand for men's footwear at the store. And unlike their other brands, Foot Action has a high amount of casual footwear. So their product selection is different enough from Foot Locker or Champ Sports, especially when it comes to footwear, that you see this difference there. Because of that high amount of casual footwear, this has been a soft segment currently across a few other retailers. Even retailers having success in the footwear market, they've mentioned men's casual as being an area that's had a difficult go of it over the last year or so. And so because of that, you see Foot Action comps down high single digits. Not a good sign for, again, another brand they're looking to build out and kind of further or advance. Now, in terms of category and not brand sales, men's classics, think Nike and Adidas, were up double digits. Men's running, by the way, up high single digits. Now, we know there's a lot of push towards the classics like Nike and Adidas. We're seeing most stores come out saying, hey, positive comps here because of all of the exciting new releases. And if you go to Foot Locker's website, if you go to Champ Sports' website, those releases right at the top of the page, especially with the Jordan line there. But something that we have said time and again is that running is one of the fastest growing sports in the U.S. If a retailer, a large-scale retailer like Foot Locker, like Champ Sports, can differentiate themselves in this category, especially at lower prices than running boutiques, which can be absolutely insane in terms of the prices there, then you could be in for a windfall, especially if you have someone that's maybe not a marathoner, but someone that enjoys running, someone that's picked it up as a hobby, and they're looking for new running shoes. If Foot Locker and Champ Sports can position themselves as the leader of this category, that's only going to mean good things as the sport continues to grow throughout the U.S. And I feel like Foot Locker's brands across the line have done a great job of that to this point, and a better job than some of their main competitors, including Finish Line, in our opinion, which is kind of sad because Finish Line had a head start with the running category originally, but they've kind of pivoted away from that. Foot Locker gobbling up that market share, and that's a positive thing to see if you're looking at the company as a whole. There is, however, a bit of a warning light on the dashboard, so we'll see if it's a check engine light or something more serious for Foot Locker. And this is women's apparel. Women's apparel was down low single digits. Now, kids also down low single digits. Men's grew mid-single digits. But the reason we're worried about women's apparel being down low single digits, and the reason this might be scary for Foot Locker, is because, as we've mentioned for the last few years, the company has aggressively tried to court the female consumer through new and different apparel offerings. And what we're seeing here is that, unfortunately, right now that's not working out for Foot Locker. And no, you can't just blame the closings of the Lady Foot Locker stores because, again, women's apparel is taking up more and more square footage in Foot Locker. They're trying to differentiate themselves as it comes to athleisure wear for females, and it doesn't seem to be working out. It actually, at this point, seems to be more successful at Dick's than it is at Foot Locker. Both companies trying to go all in on female athletic gear, and in this case, the result wasn't there in this last quarter for Foot Locker.
One final note regarding the company from the apparel division and from the company as a whole: unit sales were down, but average price per unit, or overall sales, were actually up. This reflects Foot Locker's initiatives to sell higher-end apparel across all of their stores within the chain, particularly, again, in women's apparel. This is a different strategy from the one that Dick's Sporting Goods has taken, where they've adopted a bit more of a barbell approach with some private label offerings and offerings from Reebok at a reduced price from the typical Nike, Adidas, and Under Armour products. Speaking of Under Armour, by the way, not mentioned as a brand with momentum within its earnings call. Not good news for that particular company, a company that, Trent, I once had a position in and then decided to exit because not a lot of people are proud to wear Under Armour like they were just not that long ago. Before we were recording, I was talking at least anecdotally in my experience about seeing people 4 or 5 years ago at the gym wearing ball caps with the Under Armour logo, Under Armour shirts, Under Armour socks, not anymore. And again, this is anecdotally, their products are still selling. They're still selling quite a bit of them, but you're just not seeing those robust sales figures at each company that they source out to. And their online sales too are suffering a little bit versus their own company expectations. So I think that company has a lot to look forward to in terms of opportunities in the market and taking more of that market share from companies, powerhouse companies that are still doing well internationally like Nike and Adidas. So by the way, Trent, Puma was actually mentioned as a brand that was seeing momentum within Foot Locker. An interesting note there. Puma been able to really keep their brand elevated for quite some time, even though you still don't see a ton of growth prospects from that particular company. Well, with that, we move on to our last story with two retailers looking up. It's only right that we close the show with a retailer we've been bearish on for quite some time. And so let's talk about the indoor mall staple, The Buckle, a store that's been often our whipping boy for having pushy, over-the-top salespeople and fashions, and a store that's often pointed to as an example of a mall retailer that's struggling. And while we do not like to pile on The Buckle too much, we should mention that they are profitable. Additionally, they've haven't really seen the location shrinkage that other mall-based retailers have seen in the recent past. They've only seen around 7 net store closures in the past year, Trent, despite having a lot of locations in C-class malls or maybe malls in smaller markets. Trent has actually seen 2 in the last month in malls and markets with less than 25,000 people, to put that in real-world perspective for us here with this story. Also, heading into their Friday earnings call, analysts, all 2 of them with this particular coverage, projected adjusted earnings per share for the first quarter of 36 cents, down just 2 cents from the same quarter last year. They did not, however, meet estimates. And although we might have been silently delighting in this, shareholders were not. And shares ended up falling around 95 cents or around 5% in trading Friday after the call. Their earnings per share came in at around 31 cents, which, based on media coverage afterwards, you would have thought it was more like negative 31 cents per share. So the company still, like we just mentioned, is still profitable. Other numbers from their very brief earnings release included comp store sales falling around 1.3% and overall net sales decreasing by 1.7%. Online sales did increase 5.6%, but this is far lower than what we've been seeing from retailers growing e-commerce. What we've seen is a healthy rate of around 12% minimum usually, and e-commerce only makes up around $24.4 million of their over $200 million in sales, or around 12% overall. So the increase in e-commerce sales was not enough to offset the falling brick and mortar sales. And Trent, this is sort of why we aren't massive fans of this retailer. I actually knew a person who worked in their social media program, and it just seems as though they're not getting that online conversion as a lot of other retailers in this space. And it could be for a number of reasons. I'm sure we'll get into them. But one for me, at least, is I was a customer 10 or 11 years ago. And if you go into their stores today, it's pretty much the same exact setup with very similar product offerings. We're talking about the branding of their merchandise. We're talking about the simple designing of their merchandise, particularly in their denim categories. Not much has changed. And so if you speak to somebody, maybe a millennial, a late aged millennial, let's say in their 30s, we can see that the overall brand perception is not there how it once was. And I'm really curious to see how their demographic has changed overall, or at least their target demographic, who they're marketing to as a company, because One thing is for sure, again, their indoor mall brick and mortar stores have not changed that much, and their online presence, not that robust either, Trent.
One thing we did want to mention is that their earnings press release, and again, don't want to pile on, but this isn't necessarily a retailer that either one of us care a lot for, is literally the shortest earnings press release I've ever seen. Basically, it was three short paragraphs, and by short, I mean like some one-sentence paragraphs in there, some of the legal information that's required, and then the bare minimum in terms of assets and liabilities numbers. So we listened to what their CEO, Dennis Nelson, had to say about their company's overall health, but they also had the SVP of women's and men's merchandising on the call as well. So we got a better idea as to the company's overall health. The earnings call, by the way, was still very short, about 25 minutes in length, just for reference. Usually they average 40 minutes to as much as 70 or 80 minutes in terms of length. Pretty much every number they got into on the call was worse this year versus last. Perhaps the only good number was income tax expense as a percentage of net income. That was lower this year. Elsewhere, though, their operating margin fell from 11.4% last year to 9.3% this year. And then they break down selling expenses separately from general and administrative expenses. Part of that high sales approach that Layton was talking about, that commissions-based sales model in the stores themselves, these numbers were also up as a percentage of sales, with selling expenses up from 22.4% of sales to 23.2% of sales. General and administrative expenses also increased to 5.6% of net sales from 5.1% of net sales. Basically, they're keeping less of the money that they're bringing in. They're also holding more inventory, and this isn't necessarily a good thing, as it doesn't mess with their initiatives overall as a company. It's not as though they said on previous earnings calls, hey, our sales are taking a hit because we don't have the correct inventory in store. We're going to work to bring more in. Inventory as a whole was up 2.2%, but more worrisome, on a per store basis, it was up 3%. And this reflects a backup of inventory in the stores as a result of lowered sales, but more than anything, a result of lowered sales on the basis of their high price point merchandise. So what the company has done, and Layton will address this here in a little bit, they've rolled out some new lower price point options for consumers. Consumers are opting for those, and so the higher price point options are just sitting on the shelves and resulting in this inventory bloat. So that is a concern for the company. Additionally, another concern for the company is, again, their CEO, Dennis Nelson, came right out and said it when he was asked the question on the call. Their merchandise mix has about 50% exposure to China. So when it comes to tariffs, when it comes to the potential impact of those tariffs, the buckle is in a danger zone. And he said they are constantly revisiting their suppliers to see if they can either work with those Chinese suppliers to bring prices down somehow and mitigate the impact of those tariffs, or if they can go elsewhere. But again, 50% exposure to China is pretty large. And when you compare this to a call from, let's just say, Best Buy, like we talked about earlier in the show, I think there are a lot more reasons to be concerned about the Buckle's merchandise margins going forward, especially when their margins are already shrinking. And then when you look at the breakdown on the earnings call, when they had the SVPs of men's and women's merchandising there, they clearly took the biggest hit in terms of women's merchandise sales.
Unlike with Foot Locker, where average price per unit increased, the Buckle's average price per unit sold when it comes to women's jeans actually decreased from around $82.45 in this last year's first quarter to around $76 in this year's first quarter. This extended to merchandise as a whole, not just jeans, Trent, with the average women's price point falling from around $44.85 to around $42.65. This includes tops and accessories. And when you look at that overall sales commission model, this is a 1-2 negative for the company, because you're seeing that overall price point or price per unit is falling, but maybe sales commission is going slightly up too. So your overall margins are going to be shrinking as a company, and that's not going to be good for those shareholders. Women's sales as a percentage of net sales also declined and are actually now below 50%, just 49%. This is highly unusual for most mall-based apparel retailers. The problem here for the Buckle is that the customers are now seeking much lower price points at the store than they once were. Harken back to my time 10 or 11 years ago where I bought pairs of Buckle jeans because I thought I was cool. Ends up being that I'm not cool and they were out of fashion or out of style within 2 to 3 years. But those jeans, Trent, I paid around $90 a pair for. And so that lower price point is certainly going to hinder the company in terms of the top line perspective. And the first is an external pressure from other retailers as clothing prices remain somewhat low. When you look at inflation as a whole, you still see value retailers and fast fashion retailers have really cut into the consumer expectations about price point. You can go into a Ross or a TJ Maxx and get a lot of high quality merchandise for much lower than MSRP. The second is an internal issue that we should mention here. The Buckles brand is beginning to erode where they are no longer seen as a premier mall retailer worthy of commanding those price points closer to $100, like my story 10 years ago, for a pair of jeans. In response to this decreased demand for higher priced denim products, they launched a new private label denim brand featuring price points under $50. The brand, called Willow and Root, has seen positive momentum thus far, but not enough to overcome the lack of sales at the higher price points. And they are also beginning to roll out rompers in their stores, a bit behind to this trend, but overall, as the trend in rompers likely climaxed this last year, you can see the company is still doubling down on the strategy. Some of the metrics in men's merchandise were also down, just not as much in women's categories.
And again, back to the rompers thing, I think that really speaks to what Layton's talking about, where they might be a day late and a dollar short in terms of picking up on fashion trends, the fact that they're just now introducing those. As far as men's merchandise sales, they were down slightly from last year in terms of most of their metrics, just not down as much. So when we're looking at women's price points there, a huge, huge facet for the Buckle, because again, they rely on pulling in some of those higher price points at the stores. Women's price points down on average across the store 5%. For men, this was about 2.5% of a decrease. And when you look at denim for men, they're still commanding a price point that's a bit higher than women's denim. In fact, their price point on average for denim decreased from $88.05 in the first quarter of last year to $86.70 in the first quarter of this year. So a slight decline, but a decline right under that 2% mark, where you're seeing, again, 5% declines on the women's front or higher, at least when it comes to denim. Now, one of the interesting things that was on the call for the Buckle, and one of the positives that we'll touch on, is that footwear continues to be a strong growth area for the Buckle, and they offer mostly that men's casual footwear that we talked about Foot Locker having issues with earlier on the show. They also said accessories saw nice sell-throughs, although price points for accessories still down about 1%. And they're making an investment in elastic waist shorts as well. So that's something to keep an eye on. They haven't really been known for athletic shorts in the past, but that is something that they're diving into here. But meanwhile, we talk about those footwear sales. Those were up about 9.5%. So that's an amazing number to see an increase at for a retailer that's otherwise struggling. They're struggling with traffic. They're struggling with other price points. To see their shoe sales, which are largely casual shoe sales, to go up this much, it tells you that they are doing something right there. Now, all that being said, we talked about the sell-through on accessories. They're seeing those price points decrease, so they're not necessarily making as much money on those accessories. But overall, you're looking at private label businesses for the retailer on the men's side. Those continue to grow. They represent 34.5% of sales for the quarter, but no initiatives coming down the pike in terms of lower price points like you have with women's. So we'll be anxious to see kind of where the Buckle goes from here as far as offering some of those different price points for men as well as women. If they see a potential drop in the average price for men at a larger rate than what you're seeing for women, and if because of that, you'll see some private label brands rolled out there in the future. Now, as we talked about earlier, we're not necessarily fans of this retailer. In fact, anything but. I'll never forget my basically first and last experience to try and actually buy something in the Buckle. Long story short, I was given a gift card to the Buckle and went in there, and boy, I was bombarded. I could not get out of I was in the dressing room of the Buckle for 20 minutes because basically a salesperson just trapped me in there and kept throwing clothes over for me to try on. I ended up buying something just to buy it and returned it for the cash later on because I told myself basically no reason to go in there. The only time I've gone into the Buckle since is because I'm just interested in retail. And as Layton talked about, the mix hasn't really changed in terms of the overall men's mix in merchandising. And those sales tactics haven't really changed. And really, we can blame retailers like The Buckle for the reason a lot of people go online to purchase clothes now, because they don't like that high pressure sales when they're in a clothing store. Anyway, as we talk about the share price now for The Buckle, around certain points earlier this week, they were trading at about $18.25 per share. It closed the week at $15.63 per share. So a sign that analysts didn't like the earnings call. We weren't big fans of the earnings call either, and it confirmed kind of what we already thought going into it, that The Buckle's best days might well be behind it, and they're going to have to adjust one way or another, whether that's offering lower price points or something along those lines, in order to stay relevant. As we mentioned, though, they are still profitable. They do still have a price-to-earnings ratio around 8, and they offer a dividend to investors as well, a dividend of $1 per year, which at this point sits at around 5.4%, so a healthy dividend there. But you have to wonder, as a company based in a kind of a smaller market in Nebraska, how long can they stay relevant in not only the e-commerce age, because I think that's a little bit overblown, but in an age where retailers are moving a little bit faster and retailers are looking at different metrics and using different evaluation techniques to try and stay on top of things. We just talked about this with Macy's last week. In a world where you've got Macy's rolling out all of the stops, how can The Buckle stay relevant going forward? I think that's the biggest question facing internal leadership for the company today.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast. Rach Layton and I take a look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And we start with Layton.
My looking at it has to do with Target, which is a company that Trent mentioned at the beginning of this podcast as having released earnings on Wednesday. First quarter results, that is. And if you look at the results, they're actually not that bad, Trent. They're actually really, really good and above company expectations as well. Comparable digital sales jumped 42%. It contributed around 2.1 percentage points to comp sales growth, because they include that number in comp sales growth. Overall sales for the company, and this is what I want to talk about, rose 5.1% to around $17.4 billion. Same store sales overall grew 4.8% year over year. And you see that this is a function of a multitude of things. But the reason why this is my looking ahead is the main factor here, the main piece, the main driver really driving those comp store sales is the increase in comparable traffic. That was up 4.3%. You're seeing that overall, the digital initiatives from them, the same day pickup. So we're talking about the in-store pickup or the drive-up programs, the curbside pickup. All of those are really contributing to people going in the stores and buying other merchandise. And this is something that we've talked about for, it seems like, for years now, in terms of the idea that you can pull up, maybe fulfill an online order out of convenience. You get satisfied with that order, but then remember that, oh yeah, I need to go get milk and eggs too. And so I think this is really going to be an integral piece of their strategy going forward. And this is why it's my looking ahead story, is that I think this is going to drive a lot of things for the company as they build out in a very seamless supply chain initiative here, with being able to fulfill around 80% of those same day orders via their stores. That is just absolutely incredible. And it speaks to the level of systems integration that they've been working on over the past year and a half. And Brian Cornell, the CEO, to his credit, has been saying towards the end of 2018 and towards the middle of 2019, it is going to be all hands on deck as far as implementing these systems and making sure their customers are satisfied. And according to the company, customers are extremely satisfied, so much so that they beat internally in nearly every single category. The top categories, by the way, Trent, toys and baby. So that is an extremely important point to drive home, that they're going to be highly competitive when it comes to the holiday season as well. But just a company that is hitting on all cylinders in terms of being able to fulfill all of those orders and do so in a way that makes the customer pleased, and pleased enough to maybe buy more than they had initially intended.
So my looking ahead story actually has to do with a talk in Dallas that Craig Boyan, who is the president of HEB, which is a Texas-based grocery retailer, talking about disruption in tech. Well, he was at least invited to talk about disruption in tech. And disruption, one of the buzzwords that we try to stay away from here on the show. But the interesting thing when Boyan spoke, and keep in mind, HEB is a tremendously successful business. Their average sales per unit are very much higher than just about any other grocer in the nation. He said, hey, we're investing in tech too, just like everyone else. But he believes that the answer going forward isn't necessarily tech. In fact, he went on kind of a rant talking about venture capitalists and these technology companies. He says basically don't have a viable business model and will never make money, will continue to lose money year after year, and yet because they're trying to compete on a certain level may push others out of business or take jobs away potentially from people. He said basically the way in which HEB is attempting to use technology is to augment the abilities of his staff. Now, they do buy online and pick up in store just like every other grocer does. They've also partnered with Instacart and a few other companies to offer home delivery. And again, they have around 346 stores in Texas, so a rather large chain that we're talking about here throughout the state. But he mentioned basically they're trying to look for tech to make his employees' jobs easier, and they're also investing in their staffing at the stores. But the main thing I'm looking at here is a quote that he made. And he said, and I quote, "E-commerce is a vastly less profitable exercise than selling through the grocery store, and selling through the grocery store is not that profitable of a business either. So it takes a very low margin business and makes it a lot worse." We talk about grocery stores having such a slim margin here. My looking ahead has a lot to do with how are these particularly local chains going to squeeze out margin from a lot of the e-commerce options that are being requested by consumers. That's the main thing I'm looking ahead to. We can see how a company like Kroger, for example, they've been called financially troubled, though I don't necessarily agree with that, but we see how a business like Kroger has seen their margins decrease. So what's it going to do to the local grocers, and how much can local grocers afford to do this without backing up and saying, hey guys, we're losing money hand over foot. This just isn't a profitable mechanism going forward. And if you don't have the buying ability of Walmart, where do you fit in terms of that e-commerce development and in terms of building out the supply chain to fulfill those e-commerce orders? The same thing could be said of a private chain like Hy-Vee, and we've heard them talk about needing to build out the supply chain so that they can increase the margin of these e-commerce sales a little bit. So that's my looking ahead story for this week. Reminder, once again, as we wrap up today's show, to like us and rate us, however you do access us. You can check us out on Twitter and Instagram as well, at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back with you about 7 days from today.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.